don't be too encouraged by that. I've written them in a slightly different style, and also I've made Rachel Green no promises that I'll be less than 20 minutes, but I'll try not to be too much longer than that. And I will also just say we will have a sheet of details for prayer for those people that we've just been praying for earlier in the service, and for anybody else who might actually be going off over the summer. So that will be put together and circulated in time for the activities they're going off for. Okay, so the focus this morning is on short-term missions. And I'm going to try and make this more relevant to all of us rather than just those people we've just prayed for. But I'm going to suggest we look at three very familiar Bible passages quite quickly. And then I'm going to draw out some themes from those passages. And then I'm going to include a bit of personal experience to update that, which Stuart suggested. At least I think that was what Stuart was suggesting, to try and lead on to some practical applications for today, or that might be relevant for today. So if you do want to follow in your Bibles, I'm going to start with the John chapter 4 passage, which, as Crystal pointed out, is will be very well known, is the passage where Jesus talks to the Samaritan woman that he meets at the well. And Jesus and his disciples are actually returning from Jerusalem back to Galilee, and they pass through the territory of Samaria. And you'll remember the disciples have they've stopped at this well at midday. The disciples have gone off to find some lunch, and Jesus is there, and this woman, who is effectively an outcast in her own, something of an outcast in her own community, bearing in mind that the Samaritans themselves were rather looked down upon and despised by the Jews, comes up to draw water from the well, and Jesus asks for her for a drink. And she says to him in verse 9, "You are a Jew, and I am a Samaritan. I'm a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink? For Jews do not associate with Samaritans." And you'll remember John then gives us quite a long dialogue between them, with various theological questions which the woman throws at him, which perhaps like a conversation we might have with people. Jesus is not put off. He tells her a few home truths about her own life, and that impresses her. And so we get down into verse 28, where she says, actually she goes off, she leaves her water jar and returns to the town and says to the people there, "Come and see a man who told me everything I ever did. Could this be the Christ?" And then the people come out of the town to meet Jesus. Whilst that's happening, the disciples come back. They've rather missed the point, although to be fair, they didn't really realise what was going on in this case. So, and Jesus speaks to them with the passage we just had. And he says, "I tell you, open your eyes and look at the fields. They are ripe for the harvest. For even now the reaper draws his wages. Even now he harvests the crop for eternal life, so that the sower and the reaper may be glad together." And we heard at the end of that passage that many Samaritans believe Jesus because of the testimony of this woman and because of that chance meeting. Just turn over the page to the section entitled "Jesus Heals the Official's Son," another very familiar story, and one of quite a few examples where particular people sought out Jesus. They'd obviously heard of his healing ability, they heard he was in the area, and they had a relative, a child, a servant, a slave, who was ill, on the point of death, and several times these people sought Jesus out and begged him to come and heal that individual. And it's one of those things, one of those miracles that Jesus actually does at a distance. He doesn't actually go to where the people are. He just says, "If you believe, that will be done for you." And this particular man, this royal official, actually takes Jesus completely at his word and runs home to find that in this case his son has recovered. And so we read in verse 53, "The father realized that this exact time was when Jesus had said to him, 'Your son will live.' So he and all his household believed." And then finally, let's just turn back now to Luke chapter 8, and I'm going to stay with Luke chapter 8, 9 and 10 from now on. Again, another very familiar story at verse 26, entitled the Healing of the Demon-Possessed Man. Again, you all know this story very well. Jesus has been on a preaching ministry in the region of Galilee. It's been a very busy time. They get in a boat, probably to get away from the crowds, to have a rest. Jesus is exhausted. He falls asleep in the boat. A storm comes up, and the disciples have to wake him. He calms the storm. He chastises them for their lack of faith. And they carry on over the lake, and they land in the region of the Gennesaret, or Gerasenes, or however it's pronounced, on the eastern side of Lake Galilee, which was actually a predominantly Gentile area in this semi-autonomous region called the Decapolis. And as soon as he steps out onto the shore, I guess it's a lake, I won't suggest this is kind of like a beach mission and it was sandy, but as soon as he steps out on the shore, there's still no peace. This demon-possessed man runs out and accosts them and shouts, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God?" And Jesus speaks to the man, asks him what his name is, Legion, which implies that he's possessed by many demons, and Jesus casts the demons out of him, and we don't have time to go into it now, this is a very interesting passage, but they request to go into this herd of pigs that's nearby. And Jesus lets them do that, and the pigs run down the hillside into the lake and perish. And the people, obviously, of the region got to hear about this in verse 37. The people of the region of the Gerasenes, or Gerasenes, asked Jesus to leave them because they were overcome with fear, even though they saw this man had been cured of his possession. Let's just contrast that. So those people who'd seen this miracle, they asked Jesus to leave. The man who's been healed begs to stay with Jesus. But Jesus sent him away, saying, "Return home and tell how much God has done for you." So the man went away and told all over the town how much Jesus had done for him. And if you read the parallel account in Matthew's Gospel, you'll see that he went over the whole region. And people were amazed at the story he had to tell. So in this particular case, Jesus basically sets that man up to become a witness in this Gentile territory, in an area where Jesus wasn't planning to do any kind of preaching work. Now that's three short stories very quickly, and there are three links in those stories. The easy one perhaps to spot is the fact that they all deal with foreigners to some extent. The Samaritan woman, the royal official, may not have been a strict Jew, and we've got this Gentile man, Greek man, who was demon-possessed. I don't know whether you also noticed, they're also chance encounters. And finally, Jesus doesn't call any of them to actually leave their homes. He doesn't call them to follow him in a geographical sense, although obviously they follow him in a spiritual sense. So let's just pick up on those three themes just very briefly. And I did want to say something about, particularly about internationals at this particular point. So we have international students and visitors in this church, and quite a lot in Bristol, and the other churches as well around. And it's a really good opportunity to speak to people who come from other countries who are visiting with us. And hopefully if you are, you're welcomed in this church and other churches. And it's particularly important that we support BISC, which we do in this church and is functioning in Bristol. That's great as well. Obviously, if people are going to come from elsewhere, much better to speak to them, if you like, on our terms, because they can go back. Of course, they know the language. More importantly, they know the culture. It is right that we send people abroad to do mission work, to support mission work, but we're never going to be able to do that as well as people who have actually come from their native countries. You'll never be able to do that as well as a national going back into that situation. And I haven't adjusted what I was going to say here, because I've done beach missions when I was a student, and although it might not sound quite as exotic as going abroad, I think that is a really important and good opportunity that we should be making use of to speak to our international visitors, precisely because of the fact that they are coming here and we can show them a welcome. So I think beach missions are really good, and it's a really good way of doing international outreach without actually having to go any further afield than the south coast of England. Okay, let's also move on. Jesus had several preaching tours, which you can read about in the Gospels. And these were clearly planned. Jesus moved around himself. If you look across the page to the start of chapter 9, we read that Jesus sends out the 12 disciples, and he gives them very similar instructions to what we also had in our first reading, which is just again over the page at the start of chapter 10, where he sends out the wider group of 70 or 72 disciples. So there are planned evangelistic missionary activities that Jesus did in the same way that we have them. But all of these encounters, these three encounters I've listed, talked through, and quite a few other ones with individuals that crop up in the Gospels, you will find that many of them are chance encounters. Jesus was just passing through the territory of Samaria. He wasn't planning to do any missionary work there, as far as we know, any preaching. It was just a chance encounter, and yet he ended up staying there for 2 days. Quite a lot of people sought Jesus out. There's lots of examples of that. Quite often they were people who weren't actually Jews, or they were on the fringes of communities, so they would come to him. And also we have even the case of the demon-possessed man. That was effectively a detour. Jesus was out of his way, and yet still there was an opportunity to perform a miracle, to present the gospel, to commission someone effectively to work in that area. Patrick Sukdeo, who's the founder and leader of the Barnabas Trust, says, "If you're not called to go, you're called to stay." I'll say that again. If you're not called to go, you're called to stay. And I guess the point he is making is that most of us probably aren't called to go abroad in terms of mission or to do very specific things. But if we are Christians, if we are following Jesus, then we are called. And so we are called to represent him and to do mission in that sense. I'm going to move on to a bit of personal experience, which I think Stuart was alluding to might be helpful. And I don't want to issue a health warning with this. I'm not drawing a comparison between Jesus' ministry in the first century and what I'm going to talk about, the Mosley family, in the 21st century. There isn't much of a comparison between the two, but there are perhaps some themes which might be helpful. So I'm just going to talk about, I guess we've recognised that our family tends to be the way we interact with people in a kind of Christian sense with the world around, the world in the kind of wider sense. So a friend of my daughter's, I guess this is going back about 5 or 6 years, when she was probably in about 5 herself, expressed a desire to go to church. And she doesn't come from a churched family. And it was largely on the way to church, so it wasn't really out of the way. So we thought, okay, that's fine. We'll just go a few minutes earlier and pick her up on the way. And that worked out quite fine, and we took her home afterwards and dropped her off. Gradually, she got quite settled into the church. She started to go into the other activities, so we used to have to pick her up for those as well. That's fine. Then her sister also wanted to start coming, so we started taking her as well. And then a brother wanted to start coming too, so we've taken him as well. And then various other friends as well in the school also at various other times. There have been times when we've needed nearly all the seats in both of our cars to take these children down to church. Now, that's just an opportunity that came along. We haven't put ourselves out particularly. I wouldn't say we prayed about it particularly or been terribly spiritual. It's just kind of developed. And that group, actually, of it's all girls in this particular case, has kind of gelled into a group so that now we have basically a children's home group that runs in our house every other week, which one of the youth leaders from Woodlands comes and leads. Now, my wife is quite happy to do that. We used to have a children's home group for the boys when they were younger, they all came from churched families, so that was perhaps a bit different. Anyway, my wife is quite happy to have them there. She doesn't want to lead the group. The youth leader does that. That's fine. She does the cooking. You might say, what's my role in all this? Well, actually, my role is as little as possible. Or at least I try and keep out of the way. I guess that's not quite true. I did hear a good quote about what someone suggested the government should do. Well, the government's role is basically to raise money and do the tidying up. And I rather feel that's pretty much what I do. And believe me, by the time you've had up to 12, 9, 10 or 11-year-old girls in your house doing alternative creative arts, there is quite a lot of tidying up involved. I can tell you that toothpaste does not come out of the carpet at all well. But I guess the point is that there's some mess and there's some disruption, and do I mind that? Well, yes, frankly, actually, I do. I do rather mind that, but I kind of think, is this worth it for the gospel? My wife says this children's home group functions a bit like a church. There's the core people, like my daughter and her friend, who come regularly and go to church. There's some other people, some other girls, who only come to the home group, but they come regularly. And then there's some fringe people as well who occasionally bring other people along. So we have friends of friends bringing friends. So, kind of, yeah, I think that's worth doing. My daughter's friend has been coming with us, I should say with my wife now, to church long enough that she has been eligible for a place at St. Mary Redcliffe Church on her own basis, even though she comes from a non-church family, even though her mother claims she's an atheist. Obviously she's not. She wouldn't, obviously if she would felt that strongly about it, she wouldn't let us bring her children to church. But she's been able to get that place at St. Mary Redcliffe, a Christian church. I don't know where that's going to lead. I don't know what that's going to do in terms of her life, but she's carried on with that, and it's only really requiring us to keep doing the transport, really, and providing our home for this group. So hopefully that will continue. Jesus said, one sows, another reaps. Another quick anecdote before I try and finish off with some other ones. When my son was at the same school, I should perhaps point out that we have actually tried to support the local schools in our area, which perhaps other people don't do so much. And so maybe these opportunities have come because we've made that commitment in that area. Anyway, my son was quite friendly with the only Muslim boy in the whole school when he was at primary school. And they got quite friendly. They did activities together. And my son started going to the Crusaders group at Highgrove Church, which Linda Parsons runs, so I know will be known to at least some families in this church. I don't know, actually, Linda and her husband feel very committed to living in Sea Mills and to living in that community. Anyway, so my son invited this Muslim Malloy along to the Crusaders group, and he went along for quite a few years. His parents were okay with that. We did slightly wince at the prospect of a Muslim lad going to a group called Crusaders, but that seemed to be overlooked, which was good. And I know that although my son doesn't go to that group anymore, I know this lad has gone along by himself subsequently. I don't know how much he's keeping going with that. Again, I don't know how long that will continue, but surely that's going to do some good work there, if only in terms of understanding how Christians are and how they behave for him. My boys now go to the youth service at Woodlands on a Friday evening, which is very good. And they've got several friends they've encouraged to go along from church families where the teenage boys, there aren't many teenagers in those churches. So it's difficult to kind of keep your groups going in those cases. And my boys have basically helped those people to come along and get established in that group. So I think for that, you know, that's quite a difficult age, particularly for boys in churches. And I think they've helped them to kind of like stabilise their Christian relationship. There's a group they can go to where there's lots of other youngsters. There's lots going on. And hopefully that will help them through those years until they can get to perhaps the sort of student age groups. Well, that's fine. You may say that's fine when you've got a family that's doing quite a lot. But what about if you don't have any children? or you're at a different stage in life. So I'll give you some more, some different examples of other people. There's some friends known to us from a previous church. He's actually an electrical engineer, and his wife actually, quite sure what she's doing now, but she did languages at university. Anyway, this the electrical engineer, Jeff, their children have left home because they've gone to university and they've moved on, so they're kind of free agents again now. And he works for himself. Not everybody's able to do this kind of thing. But anyway, he decided to give up 3 months of his time, presumably because he can afford it, and go and work on one of the Mersey ships when it was back in the UK for repairs and maintenance. So he's done a lot of the rewiring on one of these hospital ships that goes around Africa and the Caribbean doing operations for people. And I think he's done that probably a couple of times. And I'm not sure whether actually the biggest challenge with that is not so much giving up the time or the money, but the fact that the ship's usually docked somewhere like Cardiff Docks or Newcastle Docks, which I should imagine if you're there for 3 months is probably about as exciting as Bristol Docks. And I suspect that may be more of a sacrifice than the other things he's given up. His wife, and I don't know whether they managed to overlap these things, decided, actually she speaks Russian and Portuguese on top of everything else. She's decided to go out to Brazil at least once and help out with one of the large missionary organisations out there using her Portuguese language skills. So we have Casey Aitken out in Brazil at the moment, who's obviously struggling with that. Let's have some examples a bit closer to home. I hope Ruth Spencer won't mind me reminding you that she was out in the Palestinian territories early this year doing some humanitarian work. Neil's just been out in India supporting and encouraging and finding out what Lois and Krishnaya have been doing and giving them some encouragement. And Pam Richards is off in Borneo on a conference, but because she's out there, she's hoping to visit the Posnets and hopefully Eunice as well, I guess the situation in Thailand allowing. So there are opportunities that those of us who are older and more mature can also do as well. So just to round off, the points I just wanted to draw out. The examples I've chosen from Jesus, and most of the examples in the New Testament, Jesus doesn't seem to call people away from where they are. In fact, he suggests in most cases that they stay there because that's where they're comfortable, that's where they know the people, that's where they can actually be effective in their evangelism and their mission. So I think there's something about recognising what you do, because I think looking at our family, I guess it's taken us a while to realise that perhaps that's actually where our missionary and ministry activities are. There's plenty of other things that we don't do. The temptation, of course, is that you always see people standing on a stage talking about things and you think, I'm not doing those things, I should be. But that's not the case. If you're in the right place and you're using your skills and abilities, then you'll be doing things that other people can't do. Hopefully most of us are in the right place. We have a certain set of skills and abilities, and God can use those if we make them available. So I suggest we use those gifts and skills, play to your strengths, and perhaps recognise what those ministry gifts are. So whether you're a teenager, a student, whether you're newly qualified, newly married, you've got a new family, you've got an established family, you've got no family, your children have left home, or you're even in later years, there are plenty of opportunities for gospel and mission activities using the skills, the experience you have, or in mission support. I think there are more opportunities than might be apparent, and I think that's why Jesus says the harvest is plentiful. We just have to look around and perhaps recognise the things that we either are doing and do them more so, or see what we can or what can be done and to make the most of those opportunities, which is what Paul says in a couple of his letters. Stuart.